China's president warns his American counterpart that U.S. support for Taiwan's independence would be, quote, like playing with fire. Belarus President Alexander Lukashenko says that he wants no confrontation over migrant crisis at his country's border with Poland. Also in the headlines, Israel refuses to release a Palestinian hunger striker at imminent risk of death. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Taiwan. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. Taiwan in focus as U.S. President Joe Biden and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping conclude their first face-to-face virtual summit. In a conversation lasting more than 3 hours, the two leaders have traded warnings on the future of Taiwan. Biden making a promise of remaining committed to the One China policy that confirms Beijing's sovereignty over Taipei, but also opposing any unilateral move against peace and stability on the island. China Xi also had some tough words for Biden, likening Washington's support for Taiwan's independence to playing with fire. But in general, the two leaders called for further bilateral cooperation and communication.
A sound Chinese-American relationship is required for advancing our two countries' respective development and for safeguarding a peaceful and stable international environment, including finding effective responses to global challenges such as climate change and the COVID pandemic. China and the United States should respect each other, coexist in peace, and pursue win-win cooperation.
Biden also said that Beijing and Washington have a responsibility to avoid conflict in their competitions. They brought up a number of other issues, including trade, human rights, global energy supplies, and the coronavirus pandemic. They also exchanged views on Afghanistan, Iran, and North Korea. The relationship between the world's two biggest economies has been rocky over the past few years. Fabrizio Goldoni is an analyst and commentator who joins us from Como in Italy. We also have Kindo Zhu, a senior fellow at the Pangol Institution, who joins us from Beijing. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, Kindo Zhu, if I may. When you take a look at the way that China has reacted on the issue of Taiwan in this three-hour conversation with the U.S. President Joe Biden, it has warned the U.S. about playing with fire on this issue. What kind of warning does that entail coming from the Chinese President Xi Jinping?
Well, thank you for the question. I think for many people, you know, outside China, if you don't follow the Taiwan question, usually people are not familiar with the situation. Taiwan is part of China. If you look at the countries around the world, almost 100%, they follow the One China principle, which means, you know, Beijing, the central government, is a legitimate government and the only legitimate government that represents the entire Chinese nation, and Taiwan is part of China. So that's the diplomatic principle, and that's a reality. The problem is, the U.S., starting from Trump, actually, they created some precedents, some gestures, some policies, some moves that's unprecedented in history. That's actually sending a dangerous signal to this pro-independence forces in Taiwan. There's the secessionist force, including the Taiwan authorities. You know, they seek more international presence. They seek, separate from China. So for the Chinese tradition, you know, there's a strong unity, national reunification. That's one of the priority, or the priority of the Chinese government. So on that issue, for China, there's no way to back down one iota. So I think that's the Chinese, why the Chinese side tries very hard, patiently, to explain to Washington that please do not send the wrong signal that could embolden the Taiwan authority to take some risk step that could result in conflicts across the Taiwan Straits, and that could draw the U.S. forces into this conflict. And then there will be, say, a military conflict between two superpowers with nuclear weapons. That's unimaginable, not only for the two nations, for this region, and for the entire world.
Well, when you take a look at the issues that are at hand when it comes to the U.S. and China, Fabrizio Goldoni, there are many. And therefore, that opens the door to all these issues to perhaps have some kind of negotiations to take place, a give and take, so to speak, whether you're talking about Iran, North Korea, Hong Kong, trade. The list is rather long. Do you think that the two leaders speaking, what can be given and be taken on these several issues, which there are so many, in order for there to reach some kind of consensus? Because as it is, it seems like the U.S., based on the facts on the ground, is more aggressive in its posturing, especially military posturing when it comes to China.
Yeah.
But
I think that the... Sorry.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Fabrizio Goldoni, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay, yes. For me, I can say that most important things that we had with this meeting and the two leaders, they have the chance to talk each other for a very reasonable amount of time. That is, we said that is 3.5 hours, and definitely it was quite well prepared the meeting, and for sure there were some people that said why they didn't meet each other at the G20, but for sure it was not the right time, the right place to do that. In my opinion, the meeting is important because come to a moment where, frankly speaking, the relationship between China and the U.S. have reached a very low point. With a lot of disagreement, a lot of files, as you have mentioned before, there are many files open of a disagreement or friction between China and U.S. So it is very important to have a meeting at this point that can start, a future dialogue on this issue and step by step solve it. Because otherwise the situation could have could degenerate even further. So mm-hmm. It was, in my opinion, very positive. I agree that most of the problem comes from Washington, comes from the previous plural form administrations, and now is the time to sit down together and start to work through the files. Mm-hmm. And clearly, Taiwan is the most important issue. It's the red line, in my opinion.
Okay. Well, Ken Doshu, let's really break this down and cut the fluff away and be very honest as to where these two countries stand. I mean, do you see there being breakthroughs on any of these issues? Do you see there being any signals being sent from the U.S. that is going to back away from its military posturing in the South China Sea, in terms of trade, in terms of Iran, in terms of North Korea? You know what I mean? I mean, here we have a U.S. that has made up its mind way back from the days of the former U.S. President Barack Obama and his pivot to the East, moving forward. So that's a long time for the U.S. to continue with its posturing. Any breakthroughs that you see on any of these fronts that they have discussed in this three-hour meeting?
That's a good question. We are still waiting for more and more details coming from both sides. A release of information for this half more than 3 hours, discussion. But in general, people don't expect breakthroughs on specific issues. If there are probably a trade issue, tariff reduction, that's probably all. People talked about the resumption of the opening of consulate in both countries, which were closed by Donald Trump. Remember, but we are not seeing that yet. But let me put it this way: I think the relationship we are talking about, the deterioration of the relationship. But remember, why it has become at this low point, mostly because remember which country started this trade war, which was expanded into tech war. Against the Huawei, ZTE, and a dozen of the Chinese high-tech companies, and then students, Chinese students were affected, consulates closed, journalists that were driven out of the United States. Remember, it's the U.S. Which took the first step in every turn or in every step worsening this relationship. And why it is worsening? It's a fundamental issue here, that is, the U.S. attitude toward their relationship with China has changed. Previously, previous decades, I would say, there was the engagement policy. There are differences, but they can overcome those differences and maintain a rather friendly cooperation. But now, the U.S. attitude toward China has changed. They say, we are in a strategic competition with China. So they started this Cold War-like policies against China, very hostile toward China in a variety of sectors. I think there's a concern, there's a lack of confidence, there's worry that China may replace the U.S. to become the number one economy, for example, or the U.S. primacy is being challenged by China. You know, the U.S. enjoys this exceptionalism practice around the world. Like U.S. is always talking about you know, human rights issues in other countries, not in their own countries, like they are perfect, remember? So they are very offensive. Basically, they are dealing with other countries, China included. So that is the key problem. If the U.S., you know, they are not changing their mentality, I'm not that optimistic about this bilateral relationship, you know, despite all these long and friendly discussions between the two leaders. Remember, Biden could become a lame duck next year when there is this midterm election. Remember, Democrats are likely to lose some seats in the Congress. And in 2024, if not Donald Trump or someone like Donald Trump will come back to the White House, it's also a likely scenario. So, you know, even we have this, you know, friendly discussions, the Chinese side would be legitimate to question, you know, how is Washington to implement those principles or those agreements? Can we have trust in your ability to implement those consensus, for example, by the two leaders? That mm-hmm. is a big question mark.
Thank you very much for that. Let me thank you, Fabrizio Goldoni, for your comments, analyst and commentator from Como, Italy, and thank you, Quinn Dozhu, senior fellow at the Pangol Institution from Beijing. Many thanks. Moving on with the news, Belarus does not want confrontation. That is what President Alexander Lukashenko has to say in the wake of new sanctions by the European Union over a spiraling migrant crisis. Lukashenko says the issue of migrants stranded at the Belarus-Poland border should not lead to clashes with the EU. The president says that he is planning to call German Chancellor Angela Merkel for a second time to further discuss his proposal to end the crisis. The EU is accusing Belarus of pushing the migrants to the border to get concessions from the bloc in retaliation for sanctions, but Minsk dismisses the accusation as absurd. Thousands of migrants, mostly from the Middle East and Asia, are currently camped at the EU's external border in Belarus in freezing cold. They are hoping to cross the border, but Poland and Lithuania are pushing them back. At least 8 of them have died. Author and commentator John Stepling believes that NATO countries, Poland in particular, are responsible for the current migrant crisis.
The current crisis, though, is fomented by NATO countries, Poland in particular, and the Polish government is a right-wing, fanatically nationalistic, anti-communist government that will do anything the United States asks of them. Remember that the Poles were a huge part of the coalition in the war against Iraq, which is the cause of this immigration crisis, refugee crisis to begin with. So they're actually far more responsible for all of this than Belarus is. But they're doing what the U.S. instructs them to do, and that is to create some kind of, you know, social disruption, anything that will allow the U.S. and NATO to apply pressure and to threaten Belarus. The pipeline, a very important Gazprom, Russian-owned pipeline, runs through Belarus into Poland, into Germany. If Lukashenko cuts that off at the beginning of winter, there are going to be, you know, huge consequences. It may be what the West wants. They want a pretext to literally invade Belarus if the color revolution fails.
Israel's top court has dismissed an appeal for the immediate release of a hunger-striking Palestinian prisoner who is at imminent risk of death. This is the fourth time that the Israeli Supreme Court has rejected a petition submitted for the release of Kayet Fasfus. The Palestinian Commission for Prisoners says that the rejection shows the Israeli officials' indifference and deliberate criminal disregard for the life of the inmate. 34-year-old Fasfus has been on a hunger strike for 125 days in protest at his indefinite detention without charge or trial. Four other Palestinians are also refusing food for months over their so-called administrative detention. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has expressed support for the detainees. It's calling for urgent international action to save their lives. Our Ramallah correspondent Mona Kandil has been following the latest developments on these Palestinian hunger strikers. She says Israel refuses to heed their demands for the fear that it would set a precedent for other prisoners and encourage more strike actions.
The Israeli regime rejects to deal with his legal demands because they don't want more Palestinians, especially administrative detainees, to start another hunger strikes and to, in according to them, these hunger strikes would be pressurizing the Israeli regime to accept their demands and end their illegal detention. So the Israeli authorities refuse to deal with the hunger strikers' demands unless they are literally on verge of death. And this is what happened with Miqdad al-Qawasmi last Thursday, and this is what's going on now with Kayet Fasfus. Those Palestinian prisoners, of course, they are administrative detainees, but they are in different Israeli jails. We are speaking about over 20 Israeli jails across the occupied territories. The administrative detainees are from all Palestinian cities because administrative detention gives the Israeli regime a green light according to their laws to keep Palestinians behind bars without charge or trial. Their lawyers and they themselves do not know what they have done in order to be arrested.
And that is it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz. Every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com. /EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. Or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba vujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The birth of the Holy Prophet, the beginning of a new era in human life. This is a part of a speech delivered on October 24, 2021, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic and foreign participants in the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference.
The responsibility that God placed on his shoulders, Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, is just as great. Because of this great responsibility, God says, Allah did confer a great favor on the believers when he sent among them an apostle from among themselves. Quran, Surah 3, verse 164. God conferred a favor on humanity. Such is the greatness of the Holy Prophet. God, the Exalted, revealed the hidden book to the holy heart of the Holy Prophet, uttered it through his pure tongue, entrusted him with the plan for humanity's felicity in its entirety, and commissioned him to carry out this plan and to demand that his followers carry it out as well.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The duty of the believers towards the Holy Prophet in every era. Well, we are the followers of the Holy Prophet. We associate ourselves with the Holy Prophet. What is our duty? In every era, the duty of the believers is to see what position they are in, what religion asks of them, what duty has been entrusted to them, what things they should think about, and what they should do. They should understand these in every era. Well, religious scholars and intellectuals have discussed these issues at great length. I will discuss a few points in this regard. One point is about the Islamic nation, and another is about Iran and the Islamic Republic of Iran. The first duty of the Islamic nation at the current time, acting in accordance with Islam's all-inclusiveness. Regarding the issue related to the Islamic nation and the Muslims in general, two points should receive our attention. One is the issue of acting in accordance with the all-inclusiveness of Islam. Another issue is the issue of Muslims' unity.
Guiding me from all light fires in Greece, Turkey, and Israel.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The strategic province of Ma'arib has for some time been a flashpoint of conflict between the Yemeni army and Ansarullah fighters on the one side and the mercenary forces supported by Saudi Arabia and the UAE on the other. Yemeni forces have been inching closer to fully liberating the province. Meanwhile, the leader of Al-Qaeda's branch in Yemen, Khaled Said Batarfi, confessed that the group's terrorists have fought against the Yemeni army and fighters from the popular Ansarullah resistance movement. He said Al-Qaeda terrorists have fought on 11 fronts. Yemen's interior ministry confirmed that the Al-Qaeda terrorists are fighting alongside Saudi-backed militants in Ma'arib, as Yemeni forces are pressing ahead with an offensive to liberate the city. However, Riyadh had denied such cooperation. The Saudi-led alliance had previously claimed it has crushed Al-Qaeda's ability to carry out attacks from Yemen. But in 2018, an investigation by the Associated Press found that the coalition has been paying some Al-Qaeda commanders to leave key cities and towns while letting others retreat with weapons, equipment, and looted cash. According to the report, hundreds of Al-Qaeda members were recruited to join the coalition as soldiers.
The United States and Saudi Arabia created terrorism, beginning with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, and then moving these people that have been trained by the Central Intelligence Agency and the Saudis, with the help of Pakistan, to the Balkans, to Yugoslavia, destroying that country. And then again, they were rebranded when they moved into Libya and Iraq and Syria as ISIS or IS or Daesh.
The report also revealed that the United States was aware of the arrangements and prevented drone attacks against the terrorists. Add to it Washington's logistical and weapons support for the Saudi-led coalition. This confirms that the U.S. is on the same side as the Saudi-led coalition and Al-Qaeda terrorists. A CNN investigation in 2019 found that Saudi Arabia and its coalition partners have transferred American-made weapons to Al-Qaeda-linked fighters and other terrorist groups waging war in Yemen. They used the weapons as a currency to buy the terrorists' loyalty. The U.S. itself is also responsible for continually sending deadly weapons to the West Asia region. Washington is also responsible for providing them with heavy weapons. The program was a total failure and only contributed to the growth of the Daesh terrorist group and the humanitarian disasters stretching across Europe. Washington is also responsible for the creation of the Daesh terrorist group. It's also accused of transferring Daesh terrorists from Iraq to Afghanistan before its shambolic withdrawal from the country.
I would certainly think so. I mean, the United States loses weapons. That's beyond belief. I think it's a way of saying, well, we either drop them to the Al-Qaeda people in the peninsula, or we gave them to the Saudis and the Emiratis to pass on to Al-Qaeda in the peninsula. So it's basically hypocrisy, which the Americans are very good at. I think they learned it from the British. But certainly, these things don't go missing. They're provided, and they're handed over. The Americans are operating in Yemen themselves, although this doesn't seem to make the Washington Post. So it's, yeah, you're right that this is collusion and it's cooperation.
U.S. and its allies have flooded the region with weapons that have ended up in the hands of terrorists. This support for terrorists has fueled a conflict that has killed hundreds of thousands of civilians and children.
tensions between Russia and the U.S. are on the rise again. On Friday, Moscow said it detected six NATO reconnaissance flights over the Black Sea over the span of 24 hours, reiterating its warning that it will defend itself against any threats along its borders. The Black Sea is a sensitive security zone for Moscow, as it's located near the Crimean Peninsula, which was reunited with Russia from Ukraine in a referendum in 2014, a move that the West deemed illegal.
2014 was a defining moment. Russia stood up for itself, like it stood up in 2015 in Damascus, across Syria. And this is what's of most concern to Washington in their search for a unipolar world, that Russia would have the audacity, the courage to stand up for itself.
NATO has recently ramped up activities in the form of holding drills and deployment of warships in the strategic region, in a move expected to provoke a response from Russia along its western borders. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov described on Friday as provocative the increasing NATO's activities in the Black Sea and the presence of Western spy planes in the region.
I mean, Russia doesn't have anywhere close to the amount of U.S. military, the bases that the U.S. has surrounding Russia. Imagine if Russia had bases in Mexico and Canada and in the Pacific. The U.S. would never stand for that. So what we see on full display here is U.S. hypocrisy in the same Russophobic attitude that has characterized U.S. foreign policy for how many decades now.
The Russian Defense Ministry said on Tuesday that the United States was setting up a multinational group of armed forces close to Russia's border in the Black Sea region. The Kremlin has dismissed a Western media report that said the U.S. was concerned about a possible Russian attack on Ukraine, noting that Russia has posed no threats to any country.
And of course, the U.S. acting through NATO with its junior allies, constantly building up troops in Latvia, in Estonia, in Poland, across Russia's borders. So it's the Russians that have every right to be concerned.
In the meantime, the migrant crisis at the border between Belarus and Poland is also spiraling into another regional dispute involving the West at Russia's doorsteps. Thousands of migrants have been stranded along the border for months after being denied entry to the European Union by Poland. Minsk says Warsaw is violating international asylum norms by preventing the migrants from crossing the border and greeting them with a heavy-handed response. In face of escalating military activities near the border, Belarus and Russia held snap joint military drills in the area. Russia's defense ministry confirmed in a statement that its paratroopers were taking part in the exercise. Minsk has also threatened to cut off Russian gas supplies to Europe through pipelines that transit through Belarusian territory in retaliation for any possible sanctions from the EU. It would be bad news for Europe if Belarus moves to carry out the threat, as gas prices on the continent have already hit all-time highs and are vulnerable to any possible supply disruption.
The United States has decided to bolster its military ties to NATO ally Greece. The military agreement was concluded during the recent visit of the Greek Minister of Foreign Affairs, Nikos Dendias, to Washington. The new agreement will remain in force indefinitely unless one of the parties withdraws. The military agreement will make Greece the U.S. military logistics center in the region.
Greece has been in America's orbit and has enjoyed a strategic partnership with America ever since the end of the Greek Civil War, in which the Greek nationalists triumphed over the Greek communists as a result of the military assistance which America provided to them.
The U.S. will also have increased military presence in the Alexandroupolis, Crete, the Tochoro, and Larissa regions. The renewed agreement gives the U.S. the right to access any Greek military bases and to expand the areas for the U.S. forces to conduct military drills. The U.S. Navy will also be able to go to Bulgaria and Romania without using Turkey's straits. The agreement will significantly reduce the importance of Turkey regarding Black Sea access. Greece has been trying to position itself strategically in the region.
The Americans are encountering some problems with Erdogan, So by America and Greece concluding this extraordinary military deal, it is a way of the Americans placing subtle pressure on Erdogan, not on the Turkish state, but on Erdogan personally.
In recent months, the U.S. has sent heavy military equipment to the Balkans and European countries through the port of Alexandroupolis, with plans for further military shipments in November. Back in November 2020, Greece submitted a request to the U.S. Department of Defense to purchase F-35 fighter jets. The proposal was welcomed by the U.S. In other words, it would not be surprising if the F-35s, which were not given to Turkey, were given to the neighboring countries soon. The military cooperation between the U.S. and Greece comes amid a row between Ankara and Athens. Greece and Turkey are both NATO members, but they are at loggerheads over a number of issues. Back in 2020, Turkey dispatched Oryx Reis and warships, escorting it to survey an area between Cyprus and the Greek island of Crete in the eastern Mediterranean Sea. The mission was meant to explore oil and natural gas in that region. That led to an escalation of tensions, with the two NATO allies launching air and naval drills of their own in the waters.
The major reason behind this agreement, this military agreement between Washington and Athens, is a result of America having gathered some of its allies from the Mediterranean, North Africa, and the Middle East in an Eastern Mediterranean partnership. Now, what am I referring to? Well, I'm referring to the reserves of oil and gas which have been found adjacent to Cyprus.
Greece has also accused Turkey of acting like a pirate state in the Aegean Sea in regards to migrants. Athens has called on the EU to put pressure on Ankara to meet its international obligations. Athens frequently blames Ankara for failing to crack down on smugglers who send out migrants in unsafe boats from its shores in breach of a 2016 accord with the European Union. Under the accord, Turkey was to reduce the flow of migrants through its territory to EU countries such as Greece, return for billions in financial aid.
Well, of course, Turkey is a dangerously expansionist country. After all, Turkey illegally occupies the north of Cyprus. Turkey illegally occupies the northwest of Syria. However, there is very little chance of a conflict between Turkey and Greece. Why? Because both countries are in NATO and both countries enjoy a strategic partnership with America.
It is believed Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is using the migrant issue to put more pressure on the European Union. The military cooperation between Greece and the U.S. would give Athens a greater leverage in its confrontation with Turkey. The Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has not made it a secret in the aspirations that it has to have influence in the entire West Asia region and beyond.
World temperatures are rising fast, and that is mostly because humans are using fossil fuels like oil, gas, and coal for their transportation, industries, and homes. The use of these fuels releases a great amount of greenhouse gases, mostly carbon dioxide, which trap the sun's heat and make the earth warmer. That is global warming. This phenomenon is leading to long-term shifts in temperatures and weather patterns, which is known as climate change. The dangerous trend is causing extreme weather conditions. The impact is being felt in many parts of the world, but the worst could be yet to come. Combating climate change requires concrete measures by the international community, especially the world's largest polluters like the United States and China. But scientists have repeatedly warned that global efforts to tackle climate change are way off track. Global warming and climate change have been under the spotlight in the Scottish city of Glasgow over the past 2 weeks as delegations from around the world attended the UN Climate Change Conference. Participants tried hard to find a way forward to contain what many scientists have called the biggest crisis of humanity.
the world's largest industrial nations long struggled to find common ground. But an unexpected declaration by the United States and China this week raised hopes for a breakthrough.
Certain elements that will promote ambition.
The United States and China have pledged to work together to achieve the 1.5 degrees Celsius temperature goal set out in 2015. China's climate envoy says the two sides hammered out the declaration following some 30 meetings over the past year. U.S. President Joe Biden and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping are expected to hold a follow-up meeting soon. The announcement was welcomed by the United Nations and the European Union. But global campaigning network Greenpeace says both countries need to take concrete action. Some experts have noted that this week's declaration was short on commitments that would significantly reduce the emissions of harmful gases like CO2.
Everyone is being very careful not to say anything definitive. There are a few dates, few specific levels things we'll get to, and few amounts of money that will go to developing countries. So there's pretty much nothing that doesn't need to be more specific. You know, we're all good guys and we're going to cooperate and make this work. Well, we've heard that before.
Scientists warn that the world faces a race against time. Climate Action Tracker Group has calculated that the world is facing 2.4 degrees of warming by the end of the 21st century. If the world fails to act, scientists estimate that it could even exceed 4 degrees in the future. That will probably lead to destructive heat waves, with many millions of people around the world losing their homes as sea levels rise. Temperature rises must be contained quickly if the international community is determined to avoid the worst consequences of climate change. That means global warming needs to be kept at 1.5 degrees Celsius in the coming decades. That seems like a far-fetched wish, given the record of the worst polluters.
I'm not feeling overly optimistic. I'm not really feeling optimistic at all, because it seems like this is just more grandstanding by the, particularly China and the United States, and even the European Union, who have gotten things, the developing countries have got things to this point.
All eyes are now on the world's largest emitters to see how they will act.
Distinguished delegates,
this is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Thank you.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه الصلاة والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام قرنت الهيبة بالخيبة والحياء بالحرمان والفرصة تمر مر السحاب فانتهزوا فرص الخير.
Imam Ali, peace be upon him, said, "The consequence of fear is disappointment, and of bashfulness is frustration. Opportunity passes away like the cloud. Therefore, make use of good opportunities."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. It's interesting when we talk about the issue of the Khilafah, the Caliphate of Imam Ali alayhi salam, we find that there are many interesting points which we can learn from this accepting the Khilafah, the Caliphate by Imam Ali, and staying quiet and remaining patient when the Khilafah, the Caliphate, was taken from Imam Ali. In both conditions, when the Caliphate and the Khilafah was taken away from Imam Ali, we find certain lessons, and when Imam Ali was given the Khilafah by the people, that he was given the Caliphate by the people, we also learn a great many things. It's interesting, but in the words of Imam Ali himself, he says, "My silence in relation to the Caliphate is not motivated by fear of death." Now, just as an aside, of course, Imam Ali alayhi salam, people said that he was afraid of death, and this is why He did not stand up to fight for his right of caliphate. And so in this context, Imam Ali says, my silence in relation to the caliphate is not motivated by fear of death. By God, the son of Abu Talib is more fond of death than an infant is to his mother's milk. Rather, my silence is due to what I know about the future. I know if I say something and act accordingly, I know what will happen to Islam. If what I have buried in my chest would come out of my throat, it would come out like the lava of a volcano. You would all become shaken with worries. And so, dear friends, it's interesting. Sometimes, in order to save a bigger cause, we need to remain calm and silent and restrain ourselves. Taking what is ours in anger is never acceptable. And of course, there is a thin line between courage for the sake of Allah and anger for the sake of ourselves. We find that Imam Ali alayhi salam, he stayed silent when it came to the issue of the caliphate. He stayed silent in order to save Islam. And it is interesting that this remaining silent was not an easy thing to do for Imam Ali. As he himself says, if what I have buried in my chest would come out of my throat, it would come out like the lava of a volcano. All would be shaken with worries. Still, for the sake of saving Islam, for the sake of protecting Islam, in a very sensitive point in time, we find that Imam Ali remained patient. He remained silent. He did not stand up to take his right by force. And what is really beautiful is that after the murder of the third caliph, Uthman, we find that the people came in masses to offer the caliphate to Imam Ali. That which was destined for him surely reached him. A profound lesson indeed, brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
دمع مشتاقیا قد لسعت حیت الهوا کبدی فلا تبی و لها و لا راقی
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridvi.
What does Ali mean? It's one of the names of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Al-Aliyyul Azeem. Ali means somebody who has ulu, who is high. If Allah has made him high, nobody can pull him down. They can try whatever they want to do. You know, so when you look at the issue of Ghadir, the ayat which were revealed before it and after it, and even the words of Rasulullah in Ghadir, you know, no serious scholar of Islam, even from the Sunnis, will ever challenge the validity and authenticity of Hadith Ghadir. Of course, what they do is they say, well, you know, it doesn't mean what you understand. That's still acceptable. We can still, you know, discuss with them. But those who say, oh, this didn't happen, I don't believe in it, you know, they are just ignorant. You can't even deal with that. But those, there are many. Anyone who is an alim, worthy of calling, being called an alim and a scholar in Islam, you know, they will never deny this. And so they accept it. Because the hadith of Ghadir is one of the hadith which is of highest level of authenticity, according to Shia and Sunni, you know, science of hadith. And so they accepted that, yes, Rasulullah said that. But they say, well, you know, when Rasulullah said, "Man kuntu mawlahu fahada aliyun mawla," the word mawla means friend. That whoever is my friend, you know, Ali is also his friend. Or the other way around. And so they try to water down the meaning of the word mawla. And there also, it's a very simple method. If you look at a sentence, you know, somebody has spoken that, you look at the context, what was said before it and after. That is a very, you know, commonsensical way of understanding the speech of anyone. What was the context? And when you look at the context, besides, you know, this issue that he gathered the people, almost more than 100,000 people, those who had gone ahead, they were called back. Those who were still far away, you know, the people had to wait for them to join them. And then the prophet, you know, in that unusual circumstances makes this speech, and then he declares what? That whoever is, you know, my